Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 326 of the Roguecast, recorded March 23rd, 2021. ElfQuest versus Mask versus the Umbrella Academy.
So, we're back, and I don't have any interest this week.
You know what? It's Aliens comics are coming to Marvel and arriving this week, so what else do we need?
That's the big pitch for this week?
Yes.
Also, we're going to talk about Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Yep. Xenomorphs are loose in the podcast, and...
Do they have to be? I mean, can we just put them outside?
Nick, there's a facehugger right behind you.
I don't like that. That scared me as a kid.
We are pointedly not going to talk about Justice League the Snyder Cut. Only Nick has seen it.
But we probably could, because... you're not worried about spoilers. I'm not worried about spoilers.
That's true.
People do want to hear about it. I think we should sneak it in if we've got enough time.
We might. If we have time, we might talk about the Snyder Cut.
All right. It's all on the agenda.
And by we, I mean Nick.
Yeah. Randy will be hiding under a rock, crying.
I will sit here
crying quietly to himself,
saying nothing.
He'll be listening to Hallelujah on Spotify.
I think you're confusing with Zack Snyder, who only knows that one song.
I think he listens to that and Jeff Buckley and a few other artists of that. Yes. Yeah.
His Hallelujah playlist.
Yes, his Hallelujah playlist.
All right, so we do have some news, some big news as well there, so I'm going to run through it. Marvel launched their Alien book this week. They have just announced that they are doing a Predator title.
Right. We knew they had Predator, right?
We did. Yeah. And they just... So,
Marvel, home to Predators.
It's gonna... They should really workshop that. So they are doing... Ed Brisson is writing it with Kev Walker on art.
Oh, okay.
What do I know Kev Walker from?
He's
Gravity. Didn't he do Gravity?
No, that's not Gravity. That's somebody else.
Okay.
That's Trev Walker.
Kev
Walker did some Thunderbolt stuff. He's did Doctor Strange.
Do we like him?
He's done a bunch of. He did some of the Marvel, the Magic, the Gathering, like comic book art.
Weird.
Book. Yeah, he's a good artist. He's okay. A good artist.
All right.
So this is basically a. It sounds like the description of it is that. There is a young girl sees her family slaughtered by a predator. Years later, her ship is barely holding together. Food is running short. She won't stop stalking the spaceways until the monster who killed her family is dead, or she is. Which is interesting. So it's like a reverse predator thing.
Huh, yeah. Well,
he did Annihilation.
Okay. Yeah.
Not to spoil our pending, like, quick discussion of Aliens when we get to the comic section, but it was good. They did something pretty cool and original with it. And so, therefore, Predator, which I'm kind of Aliens and Predatored out, to be honest. But I ended up liking the Alien story that they did, and so I can brace for the possibility that Predator might be cool, too.
I just want to talk to Marvel Editorial, though. Launch a Marvel versus Aliens versus Predator.
Yes.
Or something.
Yes.
Just do something... Perfect.
They should not do that.
They should.
Why?
Do that.
You got to establish that you can handle the core title before you do the total blitzkrieg.
I disagree.
There have been 700 issues of Predator comics,
and everybody kind of forgot that they could be good. Marvel has to prove that they can be good.
I want Predator versus Wolverine.
I mean, believe me, you're gonna get it.
I'm not so sure about that. We haven't had a Star Wars Marvel crossover yet, and I feel like that would have happened by now.
That is a little odd. I think that comes down to a particular protectiveness for that property.
I agree with that.
The Aliens and Predators have been less less demure about whoring themselves out.
Right.
They should have launched all of them at the same time. Just do like a big Alien versus Marvel and then do an Alien substory.
I mean, maybe you would have liked that, but I believe I would have been repulsed by it and would have found it like as appealing as a mega crossover.
Regardless if you would have been repulsed, people would have flocked to it.
Yeah, but then you run the risk of burning them out fast, though.
Like, I think Dave's right on this, although I'm with you,
I know,
Nick.
I'm right.
I believe... I wanted the Marvel versus Aliens versus Predator, but I believe Dave is right. Going slow. We've seen how that worked for D&D 5e.
Maybe they will do the Conan timeline, because it took them about six months to get Conan into the Marvel Universe, and he stuck around.
Now they've got Savage Avengers, and it's great.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think they'll be generally looking to, beyond any crossover stuff, to the Star Wars model, which is launch with one or two things, show that they can handle the property well, and then sort of do more and more miniseries.
And I just want the longest title ever. Conan versus Alien versus Predator versus the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, for sure. It is interesting, though, because Marvel has, as Dave noted, they've taken back Star Wars. They took back Conan. And I think when they did all this...
They essentially pillaged Dark Horse's... licensed properties.
I think we were all like kind of like Conan'd out, Star Wars'd out, but they've done such a good job with them that they've all been really well done.
Yep.
So I think that they're...
You know, they're going to buy the mask from Dark Horse next.
I will say Dark Horse has replaced their licensed properties with other properties that are doing like just as well.
They've got Umbrella Academy, they've got Cyberpunk.
Critical Role. They're still pretty decently smart, but yeah, it's got to hurt to lose mega properties. Yep.
And they've got ElfQuest, Dave. What about ElfQuest?
I like ElfQuest.
And they just launched the James Tocco book last week.
But now they can't do ElfQuest versus Aliens versus Predator versus Darkness.
I know. I needed to see what happens
versus
when
Mask.
Cutter and Skywise killed a Xenomorph.
So they can just do ElfQuest versus Mask.
Yes. That's where we're at.
Yeah.
Versus the Umbrella Academy.
Versus Concrete.
Nobody knows who Concrete is anymore.
That's true.
Russell, do you know who Concrete is?
I like, Nick, how you talked for a second, and it was like you were talking to me, and then I realized you were not talking to somebody you thought was in the room.
Right.
You were talking to our fan, Russell.
Yes, I was,
the only listener.
The only person, This was running with a gag.
Yeah. Listen, we occasionally have a second listener. Rob listens to us as well.
We have two listeners.
Rob and Russell, and that's it.
See, if you want to get mentioned on the podcast, just send us an email, and you'll get mentioned.
Eventually,
we'll be up to five people we mention on the podcast. The five people we make this podcast for every week.
Yep.
Not related to comics, but Justified writers are launching a new Elmore Laird-inspired TV show.
Yay.
City Primeval, which is... have you read this book, Nick?
No, I have not.
So this is one I've read. I've not read all of Elmore Laird's books. He wrote a billion of them.
Yes, he did.
But this one is set in Detroit. It's a cop named Raymond Cruz. I believe he's dealing with an out-of-control drug dealer in this book.
He, too, likes our names.
He does. but I believe... that this character showed up in Out of Sight. He is at like the crime scene when the lead character goes to
get his ex-wife.
Nope, not his ex-wife. It's the guy in Detroit. It's like the guy who gets murdered. Solomon. He's at the Eddie Solomon murder.
Okay.
He's briefly in the movie, but he is one of Elmore Leonard's, kind of like Raylan Givens, a guy who's been in other stuff. And
can Maximum Bob be in here?
That'd be awesome. You know they did. In Justified, not Maximum Bob, but a Maximum Bob-esque character.
Played by...
Stephen Root.
Stephen Root, yeah.
So, the other exciting rumor is that Raylan Givens may show up in City Primeval, will play it again by Timothy Oliphant.
That would be amazing.
So, I've always... After Justified ended, I really thought they should have done another Elmore Leonard universe book.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad that they're going to
do There should just
show.
Be a show that is the Raylan or the Elmore Leonard
Elmore
universe.
Elmore Leonard universe, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd be all for that. But that's exciting.
It's just one of those things where, you know, kind of like the MCU, where there's going to be, like, this history of, like, many, many adaptations of Elmore Leonard, none of which were, like, really particularly connected well. But then somebody will come along in the year 2029 and formally do this and get it all right.
Michael Keaton is not doing much. He can come back as Ray Nicolette.
That'd be
amazing.
It'd be
fantastic.
I mean, here's the thing. There's already a lot of good movies. It's just that they didn't particularly do that much. There was some shared
they
stuff.
They did one. In Jackie Brown, they had Michael Keaton come back and play Ray Nicolette that he had played in Out of Sight.
Out of Sight, yeah.
So they did do that once.
Oh, man, I just thought of Out of Sight, and I'm like, oh, Dennis Farina is
sad. I know. Anyway, then going back to comics news, DC has announced a new book called Nice House on the Lake by James Tinian. It's a black label book from them.
Okay.
So it is a...
this is one of those... To me, at a quick glance, it looked like it could have been a Hill House comic.
Yeah.
Like, it is not... It didn't look like it was very DC.
It's not.
Hill House slash Vertigo.
Did they just decide that... Yeah, were the Hill House released through the black label?
Yes.
Okay, so this is just like that, but without the official sanction of, like, the Joe Hill as curator.
Well, this is not a Joe Hill book.
This is DC being like, Timian, can you do something that's killing the children over here at DC?
I actually think it's exactly what it is, because they mentioned in the press release thing they put out, they mentioned something is killing the children in Department of Truth.
Yeah.
You can't mention something that's not from DC.
So he's working on he's got his own, like, big buzz books from Boom and from Image, and now he's got one from DC.
Yeah.
So basically they're like, hey, this guy who's like our big A-list Batman writer is really successful at horror. And I wonder if it was them or if he basically pitched it. He's like, look, I have another idea. I could do it in Image or I could do it there. If you guys will give me a deal, I'll do it here.
Yeah.
So,
and I'm sure DC's
you guys
like, sure.
Will do me a deal. I'll stick Batman in it.
I'll put Batman in it. So, yeah, this is a horror book. It's a great pitch. It's everyone is invited to the house knows Walter. Well, they know him a little anyway. Some met him in childhood. Some met him months ago. And Walter's always been a little off. But after the hardest year of their lives, nobody's going to turn down Walter's invitation to an astonishingly beautiful house in the woods overlooking an enormous sylvan lake. And it sounds like there may be something sinister goes on from there.
I'm going to say it's a sinister clue.
Yes.
I'm going to hope that it's as good as the movie The Invitation.
Anyway, what if Walter is actually Matches Malone?
Now, just in case we haven't made it clear, there is not DC involvement in this.
That is
to say, there's
no
DC Universe involvement.
No.
Sounds like a good pitch.
Yeah, and we know that like the Hill House books were all good. So more horror from people who know how to do that right in comics. I'm down for it.
I'm just excited for James Tynion to write another book. That guy has quickly become one of my favorites. Like Something Has Killed the Children and
Department of Truth
are both really great.
They are.
So there's been some turnover at CW. They have the new Batwoman has announced that they are going to be bringing Kate Kane back.
But not Ruby Rose. Right.
But so, they're not going to just, like, say that the character disappeared for reasons unknown forever. They are going to still use her.
So, basically, they've recast her. An actress named Wallace Day is going to play her. And, basically, Kate Kane was in, like, the plane crash or whatever. And unrecognizable, has plastic surgery, something like that. Which is a clever way to bring her back in. And I think that's smart not to just kill off the character. But also, they're not going to hand the cowl back to her. I think she's going to become, like, the woman in the chair for her.
That's okay. Interesting.
This is another way that makes the TV show, like it happens with movies sometimes, more like the comics, where you have to like fix some weird continuity glitch or error, and they're like, oh, like this person didn't draw her like at all. Oh, well, let's say it actually is like plastic surgery. They had to have plastic surgery for some reason. So many
similarities with daytime soap operas than you'd think there would be.
The only CW show that I'm keeping up with right now is Superman and Lois.
Yep.
But, I wish them all well. They all have had qualities I like in them. They've all done bits and things I enjoy. If I had all the time in the universe, I'd probably be watching them.
That's where I am, too. I admire them from a distance.
Yep. And so I wish them well with this gambit. It's I like anybody trying to do some kind of little bit of hand-wavy stuff to make the universe fit together nicely.
Yep.
So I'm down for it.
Yeah.
This is a weird one. Superman and the Authority is coming from Grant Morrison and Mikael Janin.
Graphic novel, comic?
It's a two-issue series, if I'm not mistaken.
That's so weird.
The Authority was primarily relevant in the late 90s, maybe early 2000s.
Early 2000s, yeah.
Yeah.
Made famous by what? It was Millar and...
Warren Ellis.
Warren Ellis wrote it.
He kicked it off. Mark Miller took it over. And, yeah, it was Brian Hitch and the team that would later, or like, you know, I don't know if Miller worked with him, but the team that would later launch the Ultimates.
Right.
Didn't Morrison work briefly on that, and that's what caused the divide between Miller and Morrison?
I think
Morrison?
So. I do think he did a little bit of work on it.
Morrison on
Authority?
Yeah, like for like 6 or 12 issues or something in there?
I don't think so.
I thought that was where the divide happened.
Ever worked on
someone look into this on the internets. But in any case, yeah, that was kind of their, like, Warren Ellis's, I'm not just going to say realistic Justice League, but it was his vision of a Justice League specifically that involve themselves in world affairs and were not, as they kind of always have to find contrived reasons at Marvel and DC, they don't change the balance of power. They don't overthrow countries and stuff like that. Well, the Authority did.
The Authority did.
And he also, would have, like, high collateral damage, like, whole city, like, countries destroyed. Yeah. And, basically, it was a playground that was his DC universe where he could do all of his creepy, gross Warren Ellis things.
Yeah.
but anyway, and also there's a famous Superman story called that uses analogs to them, which they call the Elite.
The Elite.
Which they even did an animated version of, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the comic was called What's So Funny About Truth, Justice, and the American Way, based on the Elvis Costello song of the same name. Well, the whole comic wasn't based on that, but they took the title.
Also, it's
from
not
it.
The same name.
That's
Peace, Love, and Understanding.
Oh, you're right. They took the cadence of... Yes. They took the format. Anyway, it is an odd thing. So it is a Superman and the Authorities?
Yeah, it's just a new miniseries they announced.
I mean, last time Morrison did Superman, well, there was both All-Star Superman and the slightly, the lesser known Action Comics run.
I mean, honestly, the Michael Janin redesign of Superman's outfit looks very authority, but it also looks really good.
You see the picture? I hate it. Anytime there's a black background to the S, it always looks a little bit edgelord to me.
Yeah. I'm only interested in this because of Morrison and Mikael Janin. Like, you could tell me they were doing anything, because the two of them together are good creators.
So it says the team is Superman, Midnighter, Apollo, Enchantress, Manchester Black, OMAC, and Natasha Irons, and a Flash of some sort.
Has he smoked?
So if this was anyone but Morrison, I'd be talking about how much I hated this.
Yes.
But because it's Morrison, I'll give it a chance.
What was his thing that he did with all his... Multiversal? Multiversity.
Multiversity.
This almost sounds like it could have been like a loose end or something. He never got around to it. He's like, I did my version of Watchmen. I did this and that. He's like, I never did sort of my answer to the authority.
I gotta remember that Morrison has been off his game for a while.
He has. So. Yeah, it's like there's good projects mixed in there. You know, we obviously have like Claws and things like that. But I don't think, like, you know, I don't think any of us really ended up embracing his Green Lantern run. Maybe when we reread it, it'll connect with us better. Who knows?
Yeah.
But.
It doesn't say where, but it does say at one point Grant Morrison relaunched Authority. So.
Oh, wow, I forgot. Oh, my God, yeah. I just remembered it. Brubaker wrote the Authority, too.
Oh.
It was not good at all. But I'd forgotten it because it's so forgettable.
Not everything they can touch turns
that's
to gold.
Right, I forgot Morrison did. I don't think he finished it, though.
No, it doesn't say, and I don't remember it completely.
Yeah,
but
now you say that I had blocked it out.
So much for you. So much for your denial, sir. You may. We are done with the witness.
Moving on to completely unsurprising news, except that Netflix has announced that they are launching a Berserker anime and movie starring Keanu Reeves.
Oh, I didn't know it was Netflix.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
the only news.
Okay.
That's. I mean, we all knew when Berserker came out, and the guy looks like Keanu Reeves. We knew this was him basically writing a project for himself.
Yeah. Oh, completely.
We didn't know it was going to be Netflix.
Yeah, that's a big deal, then. Yeah. I mean, that's awesome.
I'm imagining somehow planning to do this, and it's like Patrick Stewart's X-Men pitch on, what was that show, Extras or whatever?
Yeah.
he's already seen everything. It's like, so the Berserker is always surrounded by beautiful women, and they just won't leave him alone.
he's, despite the fact that he's in great shape, there's always a buffet around him whenever he's hungry.
I just feel like Keanu has taken a page from Mark Millar's playbook and been like, yeah, I can do that too, Mark.
Yeah,
right. I can write one comic and use that as the basis for
a movie. I mean, honestly,
movie.
Millar usually does it in like a couple of comics, so he beat him.
Yeah. Keanu's like, I'll do it in one.
I'll do it in one issue.
And I'm a better person than you, Mark.
That's almost certainly true. Anyway, I have no interest in that. I was already done with Keanu beating stuff up. I like him as a person. I don't care about most of these movies.
Like The Rock, Keanu can do pretty much whatever, and I'll watch it.
So wait until 2032 when it's Dwayne Johnson, Keanu Reeves for president.
Sure. But also, I mean, Keanu's going to be in the Fast and the Furious movies at some point.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So it's going to happen.
I want him as a voice of a sentient car, like Kit. They're like, we need you to go faster. And he's like, I'm not feeling it.
And the other car that is sentient as well is voiced by
Nicolas Cage.
Pretty good, but I was going to say, who's the not Bill but Ted?
Alex Winters.
Alex Winters.
No one would know that voice.
I bet you'd be surprised.
He actually is more or less playing the same character.
Yeah. Nicolas Cage will voice their sentient motorcycle. this all sounds plausible.
What are we talking about?
Berserker.
What's even happening? All right, so Netflix is going to make a TV show out of this, that's a pretty notable.
No, I think it's a movie.
Or a movie.
A movie and an anime?
And an anime.
But still, it's not a theatrical release. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that's like Keanu reading the market post-COVID and like, oh, theatrical releases are going to be a lesser thing. I'm going to go line up my, hitch my wagon. Is that the phrase?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think a lot of actors are doing that.
To Netflix instead, but that could be meaningful for like everybody else, too.
From what I understand, most movies that were, like, indie dramas or things are being basically turned into miniseries for various, you know, streaming platforms.
Here's the thing. It seems like maybe movie theaters aren't going to be a thing anymore.
I mean, I think that's a pretty... I don't think we can make that bold a claim when we're right, basically right on the cusp, and, like, I think a lot of businesses are getting reinvigorated right now.
I was thinking that, but then there was another big announcement that happened that I think is gonna basically change things, and that is that Black Widow is no longer coming out in May.
Right.
It is coming out in July. It's going to be July 9th, and it's going to come out in theaters and on Disney Plus as a premium thing.
Yeah.
So you basically can pay your $30 and watch it at home, which, to me... That puts the nail in any interest I had in going to the theater. I'm like, yeah, I want to see Black Widow, and yeah, I'd love to see it on a big screen, but right now, I'm not going to theaters.
Even after you get all your shots?
Still. I mean, we don't know anything.
I think a lot of people will.
We'll see.
I believe that will actually be a big release, I bet. I bet it will be the first big release movie.
We'll see.
We'll see, and
this was supposed to kick off the summer movie season.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be the big May
release.
What
are we, let's see, this is going to come out in July now?
Yeah.
Yep. We're in March,
March, yep.
So April, May, June, July.
Yep.
So we've got like 4 months out. Texas is just about to be anybody who wants to get vaccinated can starting next Monday.
Yep.
So everybody will be past their 2 weeks of vaccination point by then who's going to get it. I bet that largely things will be at least attempting to return to normal. I don't know if it'll work out.
We'll see. I don't know. I'm interested because I was kind of looking forward to the May release, and now it's going to... Because it was going to happen pretty much, after Falcon Winter Soldier ended. And now it's like, well, now I got to wait another 2 months.
We've already waited...
I've already waited a year.
Has it just been a year? Feels like longer. But
yeah, well, it does, but it's only been a year. But yeah, I'm like... I want to see what the Phase 5 or Phase 4 movies look like. Is it Phase 4?
Phase 4.
We're just going to have to watch Falcon and Winter Soldier.
But I do like Falcon and Winter Soldier, but I want to see Black Widow. Anyway, this is interesting. I was not expecting this. I really thought they were not going to do it. And I wonder, Nick was suggesting off mic that maybe it was because Rey and the Last Dragon did really well for them.
Yeah, I could see it. That was an original property, no like lead-in, and I know it reviewed really well.
Yeah.
But I have not heard, like, you know, them say how many subscribers they added, but I know Disney Plus is doing gangbusters right now.
Yeah,
I know Falcon and Winter Soldier has brought in so many new...
What's that thing called? Raya?
Yeah, Raya and the Last Dragon.
Was that released theatrically?
Nope. No.
Interesting.
Just Disney Plus.
So this is different in that it will be both of them, right? Black Widow is?
They're doing basically what... the Warner Brothers approach.
Yeah.
Which is, I feel like, doing really well for HBO Max, too.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
And they're about to have a big release. Is it next week? Godzilla?
It is next week, yeah.
So,
that's pretty big.
You know, it's interesting. There's been talk of this for the longest time. The theater has had a lot more clout. And they've always wanted to do this sort of shortening the theater window, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think the one thing the pandemic did is spread out, is speed up this process that we're probably always moving to of same-day release of video.
Mm-hmm.
So people want to see it in the theater, can go see it in the theater. But if you don't feel like going to the theater, you can watch it on your streaming services.
Yeah.
And I think those may still be two separate audiences. That goes to Dave's point. I don't know.
Yeah, well, this is obviously the post-pandemic entertainment marketplace is untrod territory.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of factors into like what movie studios, since they've been so pared back, having to hold on to movies, what they're willing to shove out.
The sheer infrastructure of overall that they must have built up in the last effectively 100 years.
Yeah.
You know, Hollywood's been at this 100 years plus. Leads me to think that I wouldn't necessarily count that out yet. I think there's a lot of money tied up in it still.
Yeah, we'll see.
Dominoes can fall, though.
All I can think is how much money they're losing right now.
Yeah. Well, and like lots of companies have held on to movies, thinking that theaters are going to return. I mean, like Paramount has The Quiet Place. They have their own streaming. They could release it.
I wonder if they will, because I guarantee you Paramount Plus is not doing what they wanted to do.
I don't know. CBS All Access did really well, and I feel like the transition... I think the thing they need is something big. And that would be...
That would be big. And that's why I think it's possible we might see other people start to adopt this. But we'll see.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting to watch. As someone with no horse in the race...
Other than I love entertainment.
Yeah, but it's interesting. Like, I don't have any financial stake in Disney or Paramount doing well. So I don't own a movie theater. So, like, I'm sympathetic to people who own movie theaters.
Yeah.
but like most especially the Alamo people. But I'm like, man, it's fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're also developing a Hawkeye spinoff, Hawkeye, which is not aired yet, about Echo. The deaf Native American, is she?
I believe that is correct.
We haven't yet seen her presence, right?
Nope.
So this is a spinoff of a character we've yet to even see.
Yeah, created by Bendis and David Mack, right?
Yeah.
But they still might be able to do something with her.
Yeah, I think they could. So.
Nice.
No, Bendis is great at creating characters.
Yeah. Execution of those characters.
Yeah, that's the problem. So I'm interested to see that. And then the last thing is they announced the Zatanna movie. He's being written by Emerald Fennell, who did Promising Young Woman and Killing Eve.
Yeah, and probably on the cusp of winning an Oscar.
Yeah. That's dark and weird, though, right? Like, that's a dark and weird thing for everybody who's a Zatanna.
Yeah, but if...
On the other hand, DC has never quite been able to become anything even close to tonally consistent with their movies.
Right. Yeah.
Do you think they'll do a weird, horror-y type Zatanna, or is she going to be like...
Is she
going to
change up her...
Because Patty Jenkins did like Monster and some other stuff, but then she came on and did Wonder Woman.
Right, Wonder Woman was not like Monster.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Maybe.
Yeah.
But I think she'll come up with a good story.
Yeah. It's quite a pedigree to be doing Zatanna. So
Zatanna lends itself to doing a more kind of horror-themed story.
Does anybody happen to know, like, did she have made any statement or something? Like, was she a fan of the character? Is she?
No, I just saw this pop up today.
Yeah, okay. It's brand new.
So.
Well, that's it for news. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show. Episode 326 of the Roguecast, recorded March 23rd, 2021. ElfQuest versus Mask versus the Umbrella Academy. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, March 26th, 24th.
Randy, would it be fair to say that for like the third week or so in a row, that at least to some degree, DC's quality has sort of dominated our reading?
You're going to make me say it?
Yeah, say it.
I want it on record.
DC had a good week.
DC's had how many good weeks?
Like three.
There we
go. Yeah, it's weird. Hey, I'm happy about it. I know that I've staked a great deal of my pop culture personality on hating DC.
Uh-huh.
And... thank you, Zack Snyder, for maintaining that for me.
You'll always have Zack.
God, I hope not.
He'll always be in your life.
He's in my bedroom. Get out. Get out, Zack. I'm trying to sleep.
He's like, I'm trying to sleep too.
He's like, no. I want to tell you about my four-hour quadrilogy of Justice League.
He's going door-to-door now.
Yes. Have you heard the good news about Cyborg?
Have you heard the good news about Ayn Rand is what he's doing?
That's what he's doing.
He's perched in there, Randy, on a big stack of Atlas Shrugged, and he's like...
Dave, I have heard the good news about Ayn Rand. She's dead.
Wah, wah.
But, you know, DC has had this is their post-Future State revival.
Yep.
And
it's
so
a
far...
soft, it's in many ways a soft reboot to the extent that it's not a reboot at all. It's just a new direction.
It's called Infinite Frontier.
But, like we've been like in a lot of the new directions. Batman, Teen Titans, Harley. There's a bunch of stuff we're going to talk about today.
They went with the Han Solo approach.
How's that?
It's true. All of it.
I guess so. Do you mean...
They basically just... I think the end of Death Metal, as I understand it, and as I from parsing what people say,
there's a lot more multiverses.
And Infinite Frontier is basically they undid everything that happened in the Crisis, so all the multiverse is back, and all the New 52 universe exists alongside the original Earths 1 through 20 or whatever.
Wonder Woman did something, and basically all possibilities are
right.
Possible.
There are an infinite number of universes. I never thought that like paring it down to 52 was particularly handy. It seemed like it limited you once you kind of ran out.
Mm-hmm.
I came in on the original, right after the original Crisis on Infinite Earths when there were no multiverses, and I was perfectly fine with that, but you know, it's such a fun trope to occasionally go to a world where the Justice League are evil or whatever, that it seems weird to have none of that, especially since so much of DC's Silver Age was based on it.
Yep.
So I'm like, at that point, don't limit yourself. Yeah, just go ahead and say there's as many as you need, and then use them appropriately in the stories.
I agree. I actually think I came in like you did on Post-Crisis DC, so I was on board this whole one world kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then as I started reading more DC, I was like, oh, Crisis probably was a mistake. Like, they really did get rid of a lot of what was unique about DC and getting rid of the multiverse. Like, you know, I think that that was a mistake.
I think one of the weird things is that before Crisis, the multiverse had become, like, such a thing that it was, like, common to, like, Superman was, like, always palling around with, you know, Power Girl or, you know, like, other people from there. And the JSA from that world or, like, you know, the, like, Huntress that was the daughter of Batman was always crossing over. It was so frequent that I think it got weird.
Yeah.
Like, they were just, like... But I think, like... Yeah, if they occasionally visited those places, then it becomes more special and cool.
Yeah, I guess so.
But in any case, it seems like DC has kind of opened those floodgates. That said, I haven't, like... Most of these stories I'm reading are not, like, particularly multiversal.
They're not they're not continuity intensive.
Like, the thing is, like, the reason I'm liking Batman stuff right now is actually just because of plot stuff that they've done.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by Bruce Wayne, who lost his fortune, who doesn't have some of the backing stuff that he has, like Alfred and his mansion and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, and I just like the incidental writing on it. It's a cool premise. And then that kind of goes for a bunch of the other ones that we'll talk about some more today.
So before we talk about DC, I do want to talk about what is kind of the big release for the week.
Yeah.
And that is Marvel's Alien.
Right.
This is by Philip Kennedy Johnson, who wrote the Marvel Zombies revival that actually wound up really liking.
Yeah.
And now he's working on the Superman books.
Okay.
It takes as continuity in their little previously on sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It really only describes the events of the first two movies.
Yep.
AKA the really good ones.
So this is I like the way they do it. There's two paragraphs, and they're doing the same thing you do with like Star Wars and Conan, where they do like a two-page spread with the credits and the setup, and they definitely do the
makes it feel a little movie widescreen. You think?
And they say in 2122 they talk about the Alien movie. In 2179 they talk about Aliens. They say the year is now 2200. So what is that? 21 years past Aliens.
So
21 years past the Aliens, and it starts on a space station in near Earth orbit, where there's their security chief who's retiring, is talking to his android therapist Bishop.
Yeah, the idea, of course, is anybody who's seen Aliens knows Bishop, but it is a model.
Yep.
And even in the space of this issue, we see two different variants with slightly different programming.
Yep.
And the way they handle it is actually really cool, I thought.
Yeah.
And so there's an implication. He's talking about his dreams and stuff that shows the aliens right away. There's something that happened.
Right. And he's almost got... He's got like a sort of PTSD about
it.
But he survived it, whatever it was, but it clearly scarred him mentally.
And I don't know if he knows. Like we go
Right, it feels like it could be like a repressed thing.
I feel like they maybe changed his memories or something, yeah.
Yeah.
I really liked what they did with Bishop here, where he's talking, he tells Bishop, I'm going to miss you. And Bishop's like, nah, you won't. We can transfer my files to another AI unit down there. And he basically, like, Bishop is like a consciousness that can be transferred to other robots.
Right.
I like that idea.
And when he's talking to the Earth-based Bishop, I think that Bishop, he says something like, oh, he's like, you're a little bit more laid back. And he's like, yeah, the military, you know, version of you that on the station, the security version, was a little bit more intense or more to the point, you know, kind of brusque or something.
Right.
Like the people of this area, like a lighter touch or something.
Yeah,
like
I was
that.
Just like... There's some thoughtful, small world-building writing going on that I liked because, in a weird way, though there is definitely some action in this issue, especially near the end, it is more chatty than I would have thought it would be, and yet, although that could have gone very wrong, I ended up pretty interested in all the conversations.
Yeah. I think the thing I really liked about this is that it introduced some new ideas. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too into what they are, but... basically, the Weyland-Yutani, the sort of evil corporation.
Yeah.
They introduced sort of an antagonist for them in a way that I thought was interesting.
Yep.
And then they focused the story around this sort of father-son thing.
Right. You've got this guy's, his sort of family that had kind of fallen apart.
Yeah.
And when he gets back to Earth, he's kind of wanting to try and reconnect with his kid.
Yep.
Only there's some interesting twists and turns there, right? And that's one of those things I don't want to say too much about.
I think we all really liked this.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
Good art from Salvador LaRocca, who X-Men fans may remember from various runs.
In my head, I was trying to kind of go through like actors that some of them he used reference for.
Yeah.
Tell me that is not the guy from Mad Men and Angel.
Oh, I see it now. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Who plays the main character's son.
And the main character, in some places, looks a little Bruce Willis-y.
Yeah, agreed.
But, yeah, it's interesting.
But it's good work. I mean, he does sort of the photo referencing for, like, Lance Henriksen, but it's very... All of his action is very clear. It's not confusing, mm-hmm. does really good just talky scenes very well. Yeah.
Basically, you know, anytime I'm looking at something like this, I want to feel like it is the same universe I see in the movies,
yeah.
that it feels like it could be an extension of that and another story in there, and this does that. It has that sort of predatory corporate vibe going on, but there's some other elements that they have added to, and you know, it's still a suspense comic with horror overlaid in it, but it does feel like that sci-fi setting, and I kind of like walking around in that again.
I'm going to say this is 1,000% better than Prometheus. That's all.
100% yeah, sure. Right, that it's 1,000% better.
Yeah.
That makes
correct.
It like, I think, 10,000%
yes.
better.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it.
Yes.
Not great with math.
That is correct. I think the big DC book that we all really liked this week was Harley Quinn.
Yeah.
I feel like
Harley Quinn has been Amanda Connor and Jimmy Palmiotti and Chad, is it Bowers?
It's probably been like 5 years since they wrote the book, though, Nick. We're just used to it.
Has it been?
Yeah.
I felt like that they've been on the book for years.
They were on the book
I
for
thought
years,
they were but, up but, to it at least as recently as like a year ago.
Okay.
I think Rebirth started somebody else, and it's been like 5 years since Rebirth.
Has it?
Yeah.
I don't know if they have been off it for that long.
I'm not sure.
I could be living in a weird bubble.
I feel like, I know what you mean. It feels like it's been them forever, but I think they've been off it for a while.
In general, it feels like that's the style of Harley that they were doing, and I think any subsequent writers were, was some variant of what if Harley Quinn was our Deadpool, of DC's Deadpool.
Yeah.
Which is to say, a lot of gags, a lot of sort of kind of meta stuff.
And that's not a bad thing to run with.
Right. She was kind of off in her own wacky world, where everything was wacky.
But it wasn't for me.
Right. It didn't grab me. This one is set in the current DC, right up to and including events that happened, like the Joker War incident. And I think has a neat basic plot hook, which, if I'm not mistaken, is also the premise of My Name is Earl. Which is to say, Harley Quinn has returned to Gotham, and she's clearly kind of made some amends with Batman, and she wants to further that, almost like as a therapeutic thing, and make amends with anybody else she's wronged.
I feel like she helped out a little bit in Joker War.
Probably so. I didn't read it.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it was.
Randy, if you named this book My Name is Harley, I would have been all for it.
They should have named at least the first story that. So it's set in the DC continuity, and it doesn't it's not as wacky. Like, it actually did make me laugh, I will say this.
No,
there's a point where she said something like, she's like, you know, I'm a licensed therapist, and Batman's like, that license has to have expired, or something like that, and it made me laugh. But it wasn't making me laugh with goofy Deadpool jokes, it was actually character interaction.
This is written by Stephanie Phillips, who I didn't realize, but I think in our staff chat that we have, it's the same person who wrote Man Among Ye, is that right, Randy?
Yes, yeah.
Which I did not read,
is
but
that
I
that the
I
pirate,
good,
Lady Pirate comic?
Yeah, the Lady Pirate comic. And with art by Riley Rosmo. And I love Riley Rosmo.
Riley Rosmo, what has he done at DC? I know The Flash, maybe?
God, was it The Flash? Well, I know he did several
did he do the Dr. Fate one that had
he
the Middle
did
Eastern
the Dr.
kid?
Fate.
That's what it was. He also did an indie book called Proof, which is the first place we saw
that was
him,
the first place.
He was really good.
He is a cartoony cartoonist. He, I was a little worried. Here's the weirdest thing to me. This book looks more cartoony than like Harley's been in the last 5-6 years.
Yeah.
But the story isn't. And I think it's an interesting synergy. There's this kind of anarchic energy to it. But like, there's actually some sort of serious conversations between her and Batman. And Batman's presence in the issue firmly establishes that this is not like just a goofy thing, which, by the way, I think the animated show did it so much better than they've been doing in the comics that I'm okay with them staking that territory out. But it's not just not goofy, but it's like specifically it is going to be right up to date current stuff with Batman alongside it.
It's a rare thing, but I like Harley trying to be good.
It
fits.
It opens with it not going well with her and Killer Croc.
It's not going to go well every time.
It's not going to go well every time. Maybe not even most or even any of the times.
But she's trying.
But she is trying. And there is actually, like, it's kind of sweet. I really like Riley Rosmo's artwork, too. I think some people are going to look at that and they're going to be like, their immediate reaction is they're not going to be sure about it. But
give it
a chance. His draws a Wait, is Riley? I don't even know Riley's gender. Riley Rosmo.
He's a guy.
Yeah.
Guy. Draws a badass Batman. It is one of those kind of hulking, cartoony Batmans, yeah. But he looks so cool.
With the also, I like jaw.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give away the guy at the end, but he gives a hulking look.
Yeah.
Do that villain he brings in. I liked his design for that, too.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, just as I was looking, Paul Meon and Connor wrote to Harley Quinn from 2013 to 2017.
Okay, so that's 5 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, 4 years.
4 years. 4 years. But
okay, well, it's been a while.
And they've written some fill-ins. They've written some stuff after that, but they were the guiding lights of it until like 2017. So
what is time? I don't even know.
I will say this because you know I also tried like they did the. Wait, was it Harley and the Birds of Prey that Azzarello did that was a Black Label project?
Yeah, yeah.
That was drawn by Amanda Connor.
Yep. Right, so that's part of one of those blurring lines thing. But I will say that, like, I like Harley Quinn as a character, but there have been, like, almost zero comics featuring her in, like, the last 5 years that I've had any interest in.
Yeah.
This is the first exception, so
yeah,
good job
me.
To them.
Yep.
Deceased.
Well, the in thing, sure, but like not a Harley solo.
Oh, not a Harley.
But also, character. I mean, deceased is out of continuity.
That's true.
And so they get to kind of like the Harley
the
in deceased is like yeah, like more like the animated series one.
Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. I will stand for deceased. but yeah, this is the first case of like her own comic or even her presence in kind of like regular mainstream DC projects.
Yeah.
That I've enjoyed.
Not to be a broken record, though, deceased. Softcover comes out this week.
That's right.
If and you have not read this, it is one of the best books DC has produced in many a year.
It's a rare book where I think we all love.
Yeah.
Yep. The Mighty Tom Taylor telling a story that is a DC zombie story that has to do with anti-life equation zombies and is both like has the shock value of some zombie stories as well as having a heart to
yeah,
it,
yep, yeah.
And then devouring that heart sometimes.
Yes.
But there's super great artwork. It's just an all-around recommendation.
Also out this week, Detective Comics number 1034, which is the first issue of Mariko Tamaki and Dan Mora doing the art. This was really good.
Yeah, it's a really good first issue.
I did not get around to that one.
So,
does it feel like it shares the same space as, what was it, Batman?
Batman? Yeah,
it does.
Yes. But,
I mean, I expect him to have a different tone a bit.
They're definitely focusing a little bit more on him being without resources. Like,
okay.
They talk quite a bit about how he's, what he's doing now that he doesn't have all of Bruce Wayne's money.
That super interests me because that was something I liked in Batman.
What's interesting is he still moves in high society. Like, he's at this big...
He ain't broke.
He's at this this big dinner for the new mayor is laying out his anti-vigilante, like, vision for Gotham. And he says... He says, the Wayne family has always had a seat at these tables, even if I can no longer afford the ticket. So it's basically like his inherited, he still has that high society.
He's got clout. He's got
clout.
Connections.
And then he goes to like a garden party. He's like lives in a condo now. It's not a bad place, by the way. It's still a...
No, but...
But it's not Wayne Manor.
Bruce Wayne has not had neighbors.
But Bruce Wayne now has
time.
Neighbors, and he goes to like a block party.
That's crazy.
And
I like it.
It's really good. Again... Half of what sells this is the art. Mora's stuff is fantastic here.
Oh man, I forgot it was Dan Mora.
Yeah,
but and I you know this is another thing. I loved the art on Batman. That artist was new to me, but their version of like the new take on the Scarecrow was super cool looking.
Yep.
Looked like this creepy shamanic, however you say it.
Yeah,
yeah.
But they're definitely playing with a little bit of like what went on in the Joker War, which I never read, and now I kind of want to read it because it's clearly they've set up a new status quo. And they're leading into this thing with like Simon Saint and the magistrate and all that stuff that was in Future State.
Yeah,
they're definitely tying into all the other stuff that's going on.
I know what I was going to mention earlier that I just lost my train of thought in it. Randy, you had said something about like, you know, this is clearly hinging off a little bit of the Joker War, which was just right before the new direction.
Yeah.
But like this actually had the effect of like comics doing what I want them to do, a superhero comic, which is to make me want to read a story that crosses over into it or influences it.
Yeah.
You know, like when we were all kids and we would read some random issue and it would have a hero we liked or the Avengers first show up and you're like, oh, I want to read the Avengers now.
Right.
Sometimes that doesn't happen nowadays, aside from being, you know, jaded reader at times. I also think that Marvel just and DC just don't do it in ways I necessarily like. But... Yeah, showing that stories have repercussions, I like that. Mm-hmm. If you are doing good storytelling, even a story I don't particularly have interest in, I can be like, oh, I want to see how this came about. And so, yeah, now I'm curious to check out Tinian's Joker War stuff.
There's also part two of a backup story introducing the new Robin. Well, not the new Robin, but the new Robin costume. The first part of that was in Batman. And there's another backup story that reintroduces a character who I was kind of surprised to see.
Yeah, those stories are sort of tied together in that there's various organizations, Leviathan, League of Shadows, and the League of Assassins. And Talia's lost control of all of them, and Ra's al Ghul is gone, and they're all sort of fighting for control of each other.
In the backup story, in the Robin story, which I've had people interested in that, so I think that book's probably going to do all right.
Yeah.
He is sort of reunited with his mother, Talia, right?
Yes.
And are they sort of working essentially in tandem?
Something happened between him and Batman, and I don't know if that happened during Joker War or whatever, and he has sort of left Gotham and left the Bat family.
And I'm sure she's like, this is my opportunity to bring him under my wing.
She's dubious of him, actually.
It's interesting.
She thinks he might be working with Batman still.
Well, or that Batman has like corrupted his heart. He cannot be the true leader of the League of Assassins.
Yeah, but also that would be great. That's psychological warfare that she could drop on him by saying, like, I don't think you can measure up and make him want to measure up.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, speaking of measuring up, let's talk about the next generation of Teen Titans.
Yeah, Teen Titans Academy, which is a new take on the Teen Titans. It's actually like a school now. Like, the new Titans Tower is a school for young teenage heroes.
Couldn't they have retconned Heroes in Crisis and not made it the Roy Harper Titans Academy?
He's back, right? He's back at the end of Infinite. Like, they don't know it, but he's alive.
Oh, is he alive? Okay.
Remember, he showed up at the end of Infinite Crisis or whatever.
Infinite Frontier. Oh, that's right. Because he died in Heroes in Crisis, and I was like, ugh.
Yeah.
Well, that's another fix.
There we go.
So basically, they introduce a little over 7 or 8 new heroes, young heroes, who are the next Titans. And then
it's like on almost like sort of orientation day or like the sort of the first day of class,
yeah.
I guess is the easiest way to describe
it. So the main Titans are like the big professors, Nightwing, Starfire, Beast Boy, Cyborg, Troia.
And the previous
Raven.
Team,
Crush.
The one that had Crush in them, what'd you say? They were like the senior faculty?
They're like the field team too.
The field team, yeah.
Yeah.
This is a vibe that we've seen in X-Men books before.
Yep.
Yeah.
To varying degrees that when they're interested in the school format. Titans have never done it, and I think it's an interesting idea.
I agree.
Yeah. There's a lot of characters. I think if I have any complaints, that's my only complaint I have is a lot of characters, but I'm interested in all of them. I really like the art, and I really like this pitch of, like, Teen Titans as a school.
Also, I liked that they didn't do something like they sometimes do when they just want to, like, spread characters around too much, which is to say, oh, it's just Beast Boy and Raven teaching or whatever. It's all of them.
Yep.
It's all your favorite Teen Titans are all the staff.
And they're building up a mystery with Red X, who is a character from the Teen Titans show, I believe.
And that's actually another thing. Like, I didn't watch that show, but I know a bazillion kids came into Titans through that.
Yep.
And so I think connecting with that show is a very good idea.
I like their Titans backpacks. I know that's something really small, but I think it's cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, in this or X-Men or whatever, you should want to some degree, just like sort of the way that Harry Potter worked,
right.
You should imagine yourself, oh, wouldn't it be fun to do this, you know, aside from whatever angsty stuff occurs, there should be some element of wanting, of wish fulfillment.
Yeah. By the way, one of the students is a gorilla named Gorilla Greg, and I think that's great.
That is pretty great.
I wonder if he's Grodd's, like, grandson or something.
I feel like, by the way, between Starfire and, like, Nightwing, it would be hard to concentrate on everything, on anything that, like, every student would be ogling somebody. But I think they actually do, I think, crack a joke or two about that.
Action Comics number 1029 continues the story started in Superman 29, so basically it's the same creative team. Again, Philip Kennedy Johnson, who's doing the Alien book that we all liked.
Right.
He is doing Superman working alongside his son John, who is now a teenager. And it's a good story, and it's got a good Superman bad guy revealed at the end.
Right. I want to read this back-to-back that's Action, right?
Yep.
We're going to read it back-to-back with Superman because they are, I think, are stealthily snuck in the something of what they used to do when they had the multiple Superman titles in the 90s and they would have the little numbered thing through them, which is to say that they're connected, and so Superman fans get kind of a little double dose.
Bi-weekly, yep.
Yeah.
And then there is Batman Superman number 16, which is a... This is another use of that of the new multiverse thing. It's Gene Lynn Wang writing, Ivan Reiss on art, and he does a like a film strip style story that is basically there's two stories running alongside one at the top, one at the bottom, and one is Superman, one is Batman. It's got I think Reiss's art here reminds you sort of Neil Adamsy. It's really pretty.
And it's not just regular Superman and Batman, but like their golden age incarnations.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of pulp detective Batman and the sort of brawling social justice warrior Superman.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who's taking down landlords and wife beaters and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's very science fictiony. The bad guys mm-hmm. they're facing, and it's a very different kind of thing. I think Batman and Superman has been an also run title for a while. It's like, oh well,
yeah,
we have another book, but this gives it more of identity, which I think is kind of cool.
So, against all odds, DC's making some power moves.
Yeah, yeah. However, Marvel has a Carnage book.
They do? You know, this one is like, it's Carnage Black, White, and Red, which
black,
is...
Black, White, and Blood.
Black, White, and Blood, which is taken from the Wolverine one, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which was taken from Batman.
Yeah. So it seems like they're taking their edgy characters, they're doing them in that sort of... Basically, not quite monochromatic, but with blood added in there.
DC's doing it too. They're doing a Superman one,
and they're doing a Harley Quinn one that's coming out in trade.
It's out of control. Gets allow all the full number of color palette.
This is an anthology, just like the Wolverine one. People like Carnage. The stories are by Teeny Howard and Ken Lashley, Benjamin Percy and Sarah Pacelli, and Al Ewing and John McCrae. So it's a good creative teams, and there's little short stories. So yeah, if you like Carnage. And you like blood?
Yeah, people have been enjoying like Absolute Carnage or any of the other related Venom
There's
stuff.
Gonna be Carnage.
There's gonna be Carnage.
Yes. What else at Marvel?
Images.
I said what else at Marvel?
I don't have anything else at Marvel. All
right.
Image put out the trade of Getting It Together, which was the sort of modern day Friends kind of thing.
Oh yeah, I like that, but I never finished reading it.
I've been really enjoying it, and this is the first trade, and I definitely would point it to people who like the slice of life stuff at all. I thought it was done really well. And then, also over an image, the book Skyward, which is written by Joe Henderson, who is the showrunner of Netflix's Lucifer.
Right.
And artist Lee Garbutt. This is their story about basically gravity on Earth just
turns off.
Turns
one
off,
day.
Essentially. Yeah.
And everything that was on Earth begins floating.
This is all 15 issues, new epilogue, one big sci-fi story. I really liked what I read of this. I've not read the ending, but I'm looking forward to like cracking it open and reading all of it. And it's a good price for a whole like 15 issue.
It also has
story.
Some just spectacular kinetic artwork, and
yep.
I'm sure it'll look great in that oversized format.
Yep. I didn't realize until recently that it was the showrunner of Lucifer.
I don't think I knew that either. You know, I want to mention from Image the second issue of Stray Dogs,
mm-hmm.
Which is a series. I like the first issue of it, too. This is the one which, if you flip through it, looks like it's a Disney, 101 Dalmatians, Lady and the Tramp, one of those stories about lovable dogs.
Yep.
All dogs go to heaven, exactly, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Except that, of course, the reveal, as we knew, it's baked into the premise, is that it's just possible that the owner of these dogs, these many dogs, might be a serial killer.
Possible. I think at this point it is likely.
I mean, it's the premise of the book. but, like, exactly whether the dog can figure it out and get safe, because it is kind of realistic in the sense that they're not quite like Disney dogs. They don't know, or they're not talking to the people in it. They can only talk amongst themselves.
Right.
And they are somewhat limited to thinking along dog lines. They have short-term memory problems because they're dogs. You know, anything can distract them. But they're starting to piece together some stuff in interesting ways in this one. It is a very dark book.
It is.
Contrasting that sort of very lighthearted look of them with the killings and stuff is really unnerving. But it's also not, again, they didn't lean into like the violence of it or anything. It's more about the ideas of it and sort of the mystery as these dogs sort of face up to it. So far, I continue to be on board.
I'm really liking it.
There could be some direction or something in the in subsequent issues which will make me go, whoop, too far, or whatever. But like I kind of think they're going to find the balance.
Seems like it's resonating. I saw that Jason Aaron gave it a nice little quote on the back.
Yep.
Also, just want to mention Taskmaster comes to an end this week, and I've really liked that miniseries. It's another Jed McKay.
Oh, yeah. He of the Black Cat fame.
Yep. Nick, anything else on your stack?
I just got some X-Books. I've got Cable, which deals with him going on a date with one of the Cuckoos.
Got a great cover.
Also yeah, dealing with Strife.
I noticed on the cover that they're doing the sipping from the same drink. That drink is a tiki cup that is a sentinel tiki.
And they're being watched by the White Queen.
Yeah, it's it is a spectacular cover.
And then Excalibur, which is just dealing with more Betsy Braddock fallout.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about Falcon and Winter Soldier and Citizen Kane.
By which you mean the Snyder Cut.
Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show. Episode 326 of the Roguecast, recorded March 23rd, 2021. ElfQuest versus Mask versus the Umbrella Academy. Okay, so we are going to talk about Falcon Winter Soldier.
Yep.
We are going to talk about, Nick is going to talk about the Snyder Cut.
Yep. I will interrogate you, Nick.
But, cool. Since those are spoilery, we're going to talk instead about the thing that is impossible to spoil, because it's the whenever anyone makes a joke about spoilers, it's the first spoiler that gets mentioned.
Right.
And that is Citizen Kane.
Right.
Rosebud.
We're right on the cusp of cutting edge film discussion as we talk about this like 100-year-old.
I don't think anyone's ever talked about Citizen Kane.
What is this, AMC?
That's right. We're gonna take you on a walk through the cinematic magic that is that.
Now
I happen to have watched it for the first time in the last year.
And I as you all know, I'm adult.
Right.
We've established this, that I am not a guy who likes movies made before, say...
You're not drawn to the classic movies.
I don't like movies made before, say, 82.
Okay.
Find that Orson Welles' best performance was Transformers, so... You know...
I mean...
Nick might be adult, too.
Nick, are you ruling out the pee commercial that he did? Because that is his masterpiece.
I'm just saying, I bet Fathery would agree with me.
I'm sure he
would.
You're
not making the case you think you're making.
No, I think I'm making the exact case.
Anybody who has not seen Orson Welles at like sort of a peak, just as an actor,
yeah.
I hugely recommend the sort of noir movie, The Third Man.
Yeah,
it's really spectacular.
I've watched Citizen Kane long ago. I was not into it. Yeah. This was like as I was a probably 13 or 14 year old, so my attention span was not where it is now.
I don't believe Citizen Kane is aimed at teenagers.
No, I don't think so.
I gave it a shot, I think, in my teens too, and I didn't even finish it. So that's why it took me forever to get around to it.
So I definitely, you're going to make it back on the short list, because if you guys are going to talk about it, I'll enjoy it.
So I watched it for one main reason, and it's a weird one. I wanted to watch Mank because I like David Fincher. And Mank is about the making of, mm-hmm. right? It's
right.
sort of a fictionalized making of.
It's one of the guys who was, what, the scripter?
Yeah, or something like
the
that.
The actual writer?
Well,
yeah.
Mank was written by David Fincher's father, if I'm not mistaken.
Who?
What?
I think that might be right.
That's
pretty,
crazy.
I am pretty sure. And it was...
Fincher?
Yes, it was Papa Fincher.
He loves it when you call him Big Papa.
Let me see if I am not making shit up. I don't think I am.
Now, is there any special relevance other than, who knew that David Fincher's dad was talented, too?
I didn't know Fincher had a father.
Did think he was born full blown from the blood of a in a darkened alleyway.
Yeah, I thought he sprung fully formed like Athena.
Screenplay written by Jack Fincher.
Okay, all right. So I wanted to watch Mank.
Right.
But I had heard, like, basically that you're going to want to have seen Citizen Kane. And Citizen Kane is one of these things, kind of like when I finally got around to watching Casablanca in my 20s, where I had seen half of it in cartoons and parodies and that kind of thing, and so it was, like, very familiar. Citizen Kane was not that for me. Like, beyond the gif of him clapping...
Yeah.
And the...
Which, by the way, is a different context than I thought it was.
And the Rosebud thing. Like, I really didn't know what Citizen Kane was about.
Right. And what it is a, well, it like, technically, by the way, there was a lot of famous stuff about this, not just that it used flashbacks extensively, but also, like, there was something like, I think, was it multiplane cameras or, like, something like that, where they can show all levels of a shot in focus at the mm-hmm. same time, yeah. multi-focus camera maybe,
yeah.
As opposed to front is in focus, back is blurred, or vice versa. Yeah. So they were able to do a lot more storytelling with visuals, with pure visuals, than they had ever before that. So it's technically, you know, one of those things, really impressive things. But if you're not a technical filmmaking fan, those will be invisible to you.
As adult, did not notice this.
Yep. I don't think I particularly noticed it either, but I read a little bit about it, and it actually is fascinating to read about. But let's say what the story is, because it begins with his death.
So the story, yeah, it starts with this guy having died at this unfinished, like, palace called Xanadu that he's built.
Right. Imagine somebody who's, like, has a mansion and keeps on adding on and building yep. new wings.
And it's like a zoo. Like,
right. The zoo. There's an opera house attached to yep. it. He is, like, extraordinarily wealthy. We don't know about that in modern times because there's no dangerously wealthy billionaires.
No. We took care of all that.
Yeah. Oh, wait. We're living in the darkest timeline. We are... It's a super big danger.
But basically, this
he topples
is this...
over dead, and he's holding this snow globe.
This was also sort of, as I understand, a bit of a hit piece on William Randolph Hearst,
the famous newspaper publisher, but like one of those guys who's like, I make the news too, yeah. kind mm-hmm. of like when it's so big that he could kind of control destinies. You know, he could put a president. He could put a guy in the president's chair.
Yeah,
that kind of bigness, and that is the real guy. But this is a fictionalized, at least semi-fictionalized yep. version of his
Charles
story.
Charles Foster Kane.
Yeah. Randy, would you say overall, how sympathetic would you say it is to him as a person?
I actually find it very sympathetic to him.
He's reasonably sympathetic, although he's also like a wild egotist.
Yeah. But they present him as like this liberal cause follower and someone who... Like, he's trying to do the right thing with his money.
And when he starts out as a kid, before he ends up getting sort of raised by the state, mm-hmm. but he is a kid who kind of just wanted his dad to come out and play with him in the snow.
Yeah.
And they are kind of oblivious to him.
Careful,
little bit.
Dave, you'll ruin the ending. Give right. away the twist.
From a 1941 movie.
But he has died, and... What is it? I guess, broadly speaking, the reporters, everybody's covering it. Nobody has, like, a special angle, is that kind
right.
of it? And one reporter...
Yeah, well, the editor tells him, he's like, well, you know... Or maybe the reporter tells his editor that, like, his last word was Rosebud, figure out what that meant.
Right, they think that they can frame a story around that
yeah.
if they can just figure out what it means.
Or who Rosebud... They figure Rosebud must be some woman.
Right, and they actually approach it, I think, kind of reasonably. Mm-hmm. Like, they're like... Well, it could be this or this, so interview everybody you know, try and turn up that name, throw it by everybody, and he has left, like, a bunch of, like, kind of, like, friends, frenemies,
yeah.
and people who've been kind of destroyed in his wake.
An ex-wife.
Yep.
A child.
Yep.
A couple
mistress?
The mistress was the ex-wife, right?
I guess that's right.
Yeah, his other wife died.
Later, yeah, he did marry.
But also, like, a couple of guys who were, like, his right-hand man.
Yep.
And then someone who was like, yeah, his nemesis. Like, what's interesting is the framing of it, the story of, like, using the interviews of a man who's died to sort of flashback through his life is an interesting structure.
Yeah, it is.
And it lets them tell stories from different points in his life and sort of out of sequence a little bit.
Randy, I think you'd agree. In this role, why can't I say his
Orson
name?
Welles?
Orson Welles. Is very charismatic.
Yep.
He is you can kind of see that he's a guy that reporters themselves loved, and then he got into the news game himself,
yeah.
and he, like, kind of gets into it. He's liking being able to use the power of the press against what he sees as corruptive influences.
Yep.
But he's also a guy who is kind of into himself, and he likes giving speeches at parties
yeah.
and stuff like that and yeah. talking about himself.
I also thought one of the things I thought was really impressive is the old age makeup, because I looked to see, I was like, did they have someone else playing the older Charles Foster Kane? But no, it is Orson Welles in makeup, and it looks believable and real. But his
yeah.
like younger self is very much younger, swaggery Orson Welles.
Right. It wasn't like he was real close and they just did a few things to tweak it. They had to make him look a lot older.
Yeah. I thought they did a great job with that. The staging of it, like the opera house and Xanadu, like, they definitely make it feel like big old Hollywood.
Yeah. There's a sort of surreality to it. And it is pretty painful to watch some of the bridges get burned in it.
Yeah.
The thing with his, like, only kind of, like, casually talented wife who wants to sing opera, clearly does not have the chops for it, and he hires like a...
And she knows it. Like, she knows
she wants she's... out of it.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, you have to be the best. Yeah. You got to prove him wrong. That's a big thing.
By the way, that opera coach... That dude made a meal out of those scenes.
Oh, my God.
It was so good.
Yeah. You see him, like, yeah, coaching her from behind the scenes as she's doing it. He's, like, in the orchestra pit. And he's also just agonizing every false note she hits. Yep. And I was agonizing along with it.
Yep.
It's interesting to look at it. It did not do very well at the box office. It was not critically... It did only so well because it was critically acclaimed and it got a re-release in 56.
Interesting.
That I think... Because of, like, certain film critics who were, like, much loved, kind of.
I think when I hear Citizen Kane or some of these older movies, I always think, this is going to be, like, Homework.
Yeah.
But I was expecting it also to be, like, a long movie.
Yeah.
And maybe by the standards of 1951 or whatever.
2 hours
it was. But it's, like, 2 hours. It's a pretty quick watch. And
yeah.
Very engaging, lots of really good scenes, lots of really strong acting, really, really well shot.
And interesting meditations on, like, not just this specific character, but, like, it almost kind of makes you wonder, it's like, if someone dug through what was left of your life at the end of it, like, you know, friends you had made, enemies you had made, and anything you had produced creatively, or, you know, what your passions were, what portrait would they draw from you based on that? And you kind of can't help but ask those as you're watching it. Yeah. So,
I'm looking forward to watch Mank. I'm going to give that a shot.
I understand that, like, many of the people who worked with him on this, including the composer, came from his theater work at the time.
Yeah.
At the RKO Theater. And one of them was a then, like, little-known composer named Bernard Herrmann, who would go on to become one of the most famous composers of all time, starting with, like, this movie, but he scored... Psycho and about half of Alfred Hitchcock's movies.
Cape Fear, right?
Cape Fear, Sinbad movies and stuff like that. Like,
yeah,
he's an amazing composer. He did Taxi Driver in the 70s with Martin Scorsese. So, yeah, he's like an amazing composer. I don't think this is like his most amazing score, but he does bring something to it that you can tell that this guy was going to go places.
So let's put up the spoiler barrier.
Yep.
If you have not seen Falcon and Winter Soldier, we're going to talk about that, and then we'll probably talk about Snyder Cut. So we'll give you another spoiler warning before that. Yep. But if you haven't seen Falcon and Winter Soldier Episode 1, we're not going to talk about it.
So this is a series that, from the trailers, we could tell was not going to be as sort of ambitious, at least in concept, as a WandaVision.
Right.
By the way, just a quick aside, somebody came into the store the other day and they're like, do you have some WandaVision comics? It is interesting that they kind of think of it that way as the pairing, and even specifically as the way the show lensed it. And I'm like, you're probably going to find that these, when you do find some Vision and Scarlet Witch comics, they're pretty different from the show.
Frustratingly, however, all that stuff's out of print.
It's all like out of print. Yeah.
But anyway. In April, we will have things again, and you can buy them.
Hopefully people will still want them.
I think they will.
I think they will.
But anyway, this one looked like more like a traditional sort of buddy cop-ish thing. Now, what's interesting is that the characters, do they actually run into each other in the first episode?
They do not meet in the first episode.
But you do get some really great scenes with them individually, and it starts with a barn burner of an opening action scene.
So this felt like Captain America 4.
Yeah.
It's got the same composer, so like the music is there.
Kind of a globe-trotting adventure.
Yeah. Well, the director of it is someone who she's doing, I think it's a she, is doing all 6 episodes.
Okay.
So it's going to have one director. And I think the writer was someone who came from Empire.
Oh, interesting.
So it's not... what's interesting is that none of the guys who are involved in the Captain America movies are really involved.
But it feels like Marcus and McFeely.
It feels like a Cap
movie. So a piece. That's interesting. There's, you know, criticisms, and I'll even say that maybe some of it's fair against the Marvel movie house style, the MCU house style. But I'm like, it is also the very reason we like Marvel Comics and DC Comics is that there is a certain consistency to its shared world, and if you want to enjoy that, then yes, there's a touch of house style to it. So, but it's, I think most of the time it's an asset.
So let's talk about the
opening. Impressive that someone, like a completely different creative team, can also feel like they're playing in that same playground.
Yeah. Yes.
That's pretty cool.
But to get back to what you were saying, Dave, let's talk about that opener, because it was movie quality.
It was, it takes, you know, they had already done some great stuff with Falcon in the movies. But when you have a character who basically, if I were to sum him up, I could say he can fly. Well, about a million characters can fly. Superman casually flies and does 800 other things.
Yep.
Like, how do you make that cool? And it's like, you give him cool stuff to do. You got everything from the Red Wing drone to just how he maneuvers and the way they film it.
Yep.
The way he does will actually like do dives like a real Falcon does, where he just looks like he's going unbelievably fast and it looks so convincingly realistic. And he's doing these really amazing maneuvers against like helicopters and other stuff that are chasing after
him. I think that's one of the key things is they did this midair rescue. That's like that's a Falcon plot. Like that's if you need to rescue someone out of a plane, Falcon is the guy you send.
Well, isn't that what basically he did in the military before he became Falcon?
So this was something
search and rescue.
Yeah, he was search and rescue. So yeah, he does that, but also they gave him a little bit of what Cap used to do. Like he goes in and like throws down with three or four guys. He uses his shield. He uses his wings. Like he fights like Cap does in contained spaces.
Which sort of makes sense because you could kind of know prize it that he learned the fighting styles from Cap
trained him. Sure,
during the time he was with him
when they were in the Avengers.
Yeah.
I think that also pitting him up against like three or four helicopters and then guys in flying suits like. What a clever way to get a like flying chase scene.
Not just anybody. Put him
Batroc
up against
the Leaper.
Batroc the Leaper.
Actually, he's Batroc the Leaper in the MCU.
He's got a French accent.
No, he's not French enough.
He's not French enough, but he doesn't.
I don't know if I was just very tired when I watched this, but I don't think I picked up that it was Batroc.
Yeah, that's
did
Batroc.
They call him
that?
Yeah.
I must have just missed it.
It's Batroc from the first part of Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
Going toe to toe with Sam. Who he went toe to toe with Steve.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
Yeah. And they didn't kill him off.
He jumps out.
But I thought the bringing in the attack helicopter and having him chase down, having him have some gadgets like the little bomb that he shoots at one of the copters.
Also, Red Wing.
Red Wing is great. I love Red Wing. I love that he knows how to work on the drone.
He got to be a badass, but also they made it seem like he was in real danger at times. Like this was like the bad guy threats were serious.
And he's got sort of a friend in the military that sort of
is his ground support.
His ground support, which. Actually is a character from the comics. So
but kind of they're doing their own thing.
Yeah, probably so.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's that character's name? Torres? Yeah.
Is it Joaquin Torres?
Joaquin Torres is his name in the comics. I don't think we get his first name in this first episode, but it probably is.
Yeah.
But Torres is like an Air Force guy who's instantly likable.
Yep.
And
but seems to have some like problems that he's noticed that no one else has, but
right. Well, he seems to be like maybe a go-getter that
yeah.
I thought they were going to kill him. And I'm glad they didn't.
Yeah, they did not do that, which was nice.
But I like all the Falcon stuff, and then they do they dive into Falcon's backstory, which is very different from his comics backstory and better.
He goes back home to his to talk to his sister in Louisiana, who is still trying to. Oh, she's wanting to sell off some of their parents' stuff. Their parents who.
Well, she's wanting to sell the boat. They have a fishing boat.
Did their parents just die or did they die in the blip or something?
I think they died during the impression I got was that Sam blipped.
Yeah.
But she didn't. So she's been around for 5 years.
And neither did their parents.
Their parents died during the time period.
Right. And among other things, like they've got like this kind of house or fishing boat kind of thing that she wants to sell, and he's like, "Whoa, let's not be too hasty."
Yep.
And she's like, "There's an interesting emotional thing here where she's like, I just made my peace with this.
Yep.
I don't want you kind of coming in here stirring this up, making me try and make it work again when I was ready to get rid of it."
Well, and also Sam doesn't give up.
They also present Sam as someone a little naive. He's like, I'm sure I can. I got all the swagger. I can go in and do this.
Right. They try. Very specifically, they try and get alone. Right?
And they kind of point out the thing. They were not like super in your face about it, but they definitely point out that like black owned businesses do not get the same respect from banks.
Right. No. He was only getting a little bit of extra interest because he's a celebrity in the eyes of the guy.
But it doesn't benefit him.
No.
That's what I think is interesting. The guy basically is like, hey, can I get a selfie? Hey, will you sign this? Oh, I can't help you.
Yeah.
Like, it is only, like, what he can do for that guy, not what that guy can do for
exactly.
him.
Exactly.
Right.
Which I think is kind of... And it parallels what the dude at the museum, who I don't know what his actual role is, who's like, hey, thanks for coming forward with the shield. He wants to thank him for his service so he can give the shield to somebody else.
Right.
Like, it is definitely a, we want to be the guys that thank you for your service, but don't give you anything for it.
Yep.
I did see a lot of people questioning why Sam gave up the shield so quickly, and I'm like,
well, as much as said that, didn't he? Is like he didn't feel like it's his.
He didn't feel worthy of it,
and that was a sentiment that was already expressed, I think, even in Avengers Endgame, right?
It's a line he says in Endgame,
and so this is going to be a deeper exploration of it, and you know, I guess I guess you could sort of push back and be like, Sam should feel worthy. But, like, that character has been built up to, like, such epic degrees. You know, he's a I-saved-the-universe kind of guy.
Yeah.
I went toe-to-toe with Thanos. And, like, nobody, essentially, would probably feel like they're necessarily worthy of him. So I don't see that as, like, a diminishing Sam in any way. Honestly, we know it's just part of... It's kind of part of an arc.
It's a story arc.
We got to get U.S. Agent the Jagoff cap in there.
Yeah. I also like...
But I think it's a good story to tell about how people get used and manipulated, too.
I think it's also a good contrast. So Sam, and a lot of this comes from Anthony Mackie, Sam's got this swagger about him. Like, he's very confident... there's no doubt at all when he's doing the flood, when he's like rescuing the guy, when he's gonna, like, he's never worried about any of that. He is 100% in his element. But becoming Captain America is a different thing, and he's not confident there. And I think that that's what the story's about, and that's what's interesting.
Yeah, agreed. Right.
But I also like Fabian Nicieza, the writer, pointed this out online in a comment that I thought was very smart. His sister says to him, like, Sam to the rescue. And he says, the MCU basically nailed what the comics have not been able to do in 50 years, which is, what is the one-sentence description of who Falcon is? He's the guy who comes and rescues people.
Yeah.
He was a rescue pilot beforehand. He's rescuing a guy here.
Look at that. The Fabster comes.
He shows up to rescue Cap in Endgame, and here he is. Like, he's the guy who wants to save other people. That's his right. thing.
And we'll also probably, you know, is going to be, if not a weakness, then something that... can still cause friction. Like, his sister is kind of like, I don't want to be saved,
Sam. I don't
need
to be saved, yeah.
And that's interesting. I really liked her. I love the New Orleans setting and the vibe of it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like it was all misery. There was also some fun family relation stuff and just good banter.
His friends.
Brothers, sisters.
His niece and nephew, I believe.
Yeah. And so, like, they call him Uncle Sam?
Yeah. And the other family friends who were there kind of running, like, the restaurants and stuff like that that he was seeing. I thought all that was... It kind of elevated him as a character.
And then there's the Winter Soldier. This is actually much more Falcon in the first part. Like, Winter Soldier's just a little bit in it, I feel. I didn't compare
screen
time. It's
like 60-40.
I didn't compare screen time, but it definitely seemed like a Falcon show more than the Winter Soldier show. But
his name does appear first.
Yep.
But this is a pretty interesting look at who Sebastian Stan and the Winter Soldier is after coming back and trying to deal with sort of past sins.
Yep.
And whether or not he can actually... start living.
Well, he's got a list, just like Cap had a list when he came back.
Yeah, he does.
But
except for his
Cap's
list is all
like,
about sadness.
Cap's list was like, how do I catch up on pop culture? And his list is, how do I make up for all these people I murdered and tortured?
I will murder these people on this list.
Yes.
Because he's not murdering people, but he's definitely...
Did he begin or, like, early on show a flashback to one of those?
It shows a flashback so that they can show that he killed someone who he's now trying to make amends for.
Right.
I like the thing
he's also trying to date... awkwardly.
I don't think he's trying.
No,
his buddy got him into that.
Oh, that's right.
The father kind of, because
no,
he
no,
was
he
trying...
said he tried online dating.
He did.
He tried online
dating. So, he's not a monk.
No, but the last time he dated, like, actual dated was in 1940.
Right. Yeah, but he was a ladies' man back
he
then.
He was.
Just not so much now that he's an ex-session with...
Now he's an angsty ladies' man who's not a ladies' man.
I love the interplay with him and the therapist.
Yeah.
I love her.
That actress is great.
She is great.
She's
like a hard-boiled therapist.
Yeah, it was
super... She's like someone who's assigned to him precisely because they know how dangerous he is, right?
Yeah.
Like, so she gets to say blunt things, even harsh things to him.
It seems as though he has got some restrictions
on,
like, what he can and cannot do.
Well, it's part of his pardon.
Right, in a weird way, she's like therapist parole officer.
Yeah.
Like, we know you used to be a villain, and yes, we understand it was because you're mind controlled, but because of that danger, we're going to have to be watching you real close.
Which leads me to believe that the Sokovia Accords are still in play.
I think so, too. Yeah.
Because, like, no one is being a superhero right now.
Right.
They're all being sort of agents of something.
Well, she's a tough love therapist, too. She's at some point, she says something, and he's like, you're a terrible therapist.
She's like, I'm going to get my notebook out.
Which I thought was really fun. I really liked all that. You understand, of course, why Bucky would be a little reluctant to talk to therapists.
Oh.
Because the last one he talked to turned him into a killing machine.
Yeah. That would be Baron Zemo.
Yeah. We get a little tease of the Flag Smashers.
Yeah.
Which I like what they're doing with those guys. I thought they're, like, their crowdsourced flash mob bank robbery was a cool thing.
Yeah, that was an interesting ethos too, as opposed to like the comic ethos.
Tying it into the blip. I mean, it is the comic's ethos, the anti-nationalism, but it's because of the blip.
Yeah, it's a nice little juxtaposition.
Yeah. I also love that that Spider-Man renamed to the blip, and that's what we call it now.
Anna was saying earlier that she felt like that was almost too flippant for what was supposed to be this kind of very, for the most part, until Spider-Man, a very grim event.
But it feels like what they would, that's what would happen.
Like what would stick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
But also it seems like several of the Flag Smashers, the main woman and the main guy, have super abilities somehow.
And there's some speculation to be done on that, but we don't want to spoil that for anybody. But
watch the end credits.
The end credits have a couple of big teasers that I didn't catch until Nick mentioned them. But and then of course the big stinger, the reveal of new Cap played by Wyatt Russell, Kyle Walker Wyatt Russell,
John Walker,
Who is presented as he just kind of looks like a jerk. Like
he does.
They did a great job making him look smug,
right? Kind of imperious and smug,
yeah. Just in that one moment, it's like Sam realizes that they basically just gave the shield to somebody else.
Yeah, he screwed up.
He screwed up. And I'll be interested to see how they play Walker and how that goes.
I don't think that's going to go over very well with Bucky, honestly.
No, I don't think it will either. But I liked his costume. Like, it's a riff on U.S. Agent. It's a good costume.
Do we have any notion as to whether he has super soldier powers?
He's got to have something, right? Well, that ties into the
yeah.
There's a spoiler there that maybe that he and Flag Smasher, one of the main Flag Smashers, got powers from the same place,
which
ties into the Gruenwald comics, and I won't say any more than that.
Yeah. There's a lot coming that I think could be very cool.
I am super excited. Like, as much as I was enjoying WandaVision week to week, I am chomping at the bit for the next episode of this. This is right in my sweet spot.
I was going to say, I mean, honestly, you and I are both, like, huge Cap fans.
Yeah, and the Cap movies are the best Marvel movies, except for maybe the last two Avengers.
Yeah, but as trilogies go, the Cap trilogy
is the best.
Is the best.
Yeah.
And even though that third Cap movie is kind of like an Avengers stealth movie, it's still one of the best.
But yeah, This is the Cap continuation I wanted to see, and I was super, super pleased.
But this feels like a little piece of the second one, Winter Soldier, so I'm excited.
Yep.
I'm enjoying it, but I need to see a little bit more before I feel kind of completely hooked.
Yeah.
I do think it's really well done, though.
And then we have one more spoiler warning. We're gonna give a spoiler warning for the Snyder Cut. Nick, this movie required 4 hours to watch. You have 10 minutes to talk about it.
All right. I'm actually dedicating 8 hours to this because I'm now listening to a 4-hour-long podcast of my favorite film critics, watching it in real time, listening to their critiques.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, so I'm watching I'm listening to basically 8 hours.
Have you started listening to it?
Yeah, I'm 2 hours in.
Are they liking it?
They're liking it better than they thought.
Okay.
Which they expected to hate it.
That seems to be the... if I were to just sum up all the reviews I've seen, it would be, aside from the haters like me... it would be, wow, this is better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think that's where I came down. It's better than Whedon's Justice League, and I liked that movie to some degrees. This one, while it does have copious amounts of slow motion, because that's just what Snyder does, that's his go-to move, I feel is a more complete film.
Motion is so early 80s Miami Vice.
Yeah.
there are character arcs. And that were completely missing from Whedon's cut. I mean, Cyborg you see in the first 5 minutes.
And I understand that he carries a lot of the sort of the weight of the story.
And we get his backstory as a football person, his accident, his relationship with his mother and father, how he becomes Cyborg. His dad is played by Miles Dyson.
Miles Dyson, right.
Who loves to play scientists, apparently.
Yep.
But he gets an extended
play. Call him Miles Dyson, not his actor's name, but
Joe
the name
Morton.
He played
Joe Morton.
In Terminator 2.
Joe Morton has been in everything, and he's one of those character actors that is amazing.
But the fact of the matter is, most people recognize Miles Dyson before they would Joe Morton.
Exactly. but the character arc, even for stupid people like Steppenwolf, he has a character arc now, and I was surprised by it. But Darkseid
is trying to learn to be a good uncle.
No,
he's going on a magic carpet ride.
That would be fun. But he basically has been ousted from Darkseid's good graces because he screwed up somewhere. He's trying to make amends by basically ravaging Earth and collecting the mother boxes.
This is different from Harley's amends that she was trying
to make. Yes, completely.
And different than Winter Soldier's.
She's basically like, I'm going to try and do good things for people, and Steppenwolf's like, I'm going to try and ravage the Earth.
Exactly. So character motivations are more understanding, and kind of more fleshed out. And, I mean, Snyder's vision of superheroes is very different than what the MCU movies are. It's not all...
I presume it's like somewhat like what we've seen in Superman versus Batman and Man of Steel, right?
Yeah, and there are still funny moments. A lot of that comes down to Barry Allen.
That's what I was going to ask. Is it humorless? Because I imagine...
It's not humorless. Ezra Miller is actually sort of the character that people can connect with on kind of a street-level kind of thing, and he's weirdly funny. I mean, he's kind of odd and kind of not comfortable in his own skin.
A little bit Wally West.
He does a really good job with it, and I honestly think the visual effects for him, even though people will make fun of his running style, which is him throwing his arms out and kind of like weird track kind of movements.
Yeah.
His character is good, and the visual effects are amazing. Again, the slow-mo works well with him because he's moving so fast.
Yeah, I heard they did a bit of the Quicksilver thing from X-Men, right?
A little bit, but they also sort of expanded his abilities like to actually include time manipulation. That he could, if he runs fast enough, he can run faster than the speed of light. He doesn't want to do that though, because it can break things.
Yeah.
Barry Allen always breaking timelines.
Yeah, he really does that a lot. Overall, I don't know if it's like you must watch this movie, because I know I'm not going to turn anybody who doesn't already want to see a Zack Snyder film, but I enjoyed it, even in its weird
Nick?
4.3 ratio.
Outside of sort of the big things like too much slow-mo or whatever, what would you say? I'm curious here. Like, what was your favorite thing that was in it that was in the Snyder Cut?
It's a weird thing that I liked the most is that Snyder basically undercut Batman. Batman gets to do some fun things and some action moments,
but he didn't dominate it.
He does not get the big moments. He is basically the person who brings everyone together, and that's his purpose. And he kind of is in the background. And
Batman is all about togetherness.
but I think Ben Affleck does a good job of that being his purpose, of like feeling so much remorse after what he did in Batman vs. Superman, basically killing Clark, causing that for him to die.
Yep.
He's trying to make amends. It makes sense. Like I said, everything sort of makes sense.
Is he trying to ravage the Earth to make
amends? Yeah, is he making amends by ravaging the Earth, or more of a Harley Quinn thing?
It's more of a Harley Quinn thing.
Okay, all right.
But his superpower is that he's rich in this universe.
And now, Nick, what is your least favorite part of something that was unique to the Snyder Cut?
The music's kind of slow-mo music combo...
I heard like Diana or somebody has a theme that gets a little overplayed or something like that. Like anytime the anime is on show.
Snyder has always been a little on the nose with his music.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where it kind of takes you out for a moment and you're just like, I could kind of see where you're going with this, but really you didn't have an editor saying, wait a minute.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this was kind of all about the let him have his vision and all its excess.
But it's one of those rare occurrences where I'm like, okay, you did have some good ideas. They're not executed amazingly, but I can see that you really did have character arcs that you wanted to do. And Whedon basically rewrote your entire film and kicked Cyborg to the curb, essentially. Yeah.
Although, I will say this, because that makes it sound like it was like this vengeful act or something.
Well,
my understanding is that they hired him to take a 4-hour cut and make it a 2-hour movie.
Yeah, but didn't use but like 20% of what Snyder shot.
Really? Did that much reshoots?
That's what I understood.
Huh. Do you think that you could have done kept Cyborg's story and still kept it as a 2-hour movie?
Yes.
Okay.
See, that's kind of if I don't want to watch it, but I think that what people are saying is there's a good 2-hour movie in here somewhere. The 4 hours is really, really self-indulgent.
Yeah.
And so what we need is not the Snyder Cut, but the someone else cuts the Snyder Cut.
Yeah. I agree with that. There is a good movie in here somewhere.
Michael Bay's Snyder Cut.
Oh, God.
And then there's the apocalypse stuff that's sort of as a sort of epilogue
set up for his the rest of his trilogy is never going to happen.
Yeah, it's a weird kind of post-apocalyptic Road Warrior about Superman gone evil because Lois was dead and now he's working for Darkseid.
Yeah.
And it's like a group of misfits working together. It's like Flash, Batman, Mera, Deathstroke, and Joker, of all people.
That's really weird. Okay.
And Jared Leto does a pretty good Joker in this. I mean, it's an interesting 10 minutes. But yeah.
Deathstroke has a mohawk. Drops the F-bombs.
No, but there are four big F-bombs in it.
Four?
Yeah. They got to do four. Cyborg drops one. Batman drops one. And I can't remember who does the other two. It might have been the Flash in one kind of, like, regards. Like, when he's running and Superman sees
Holy
him.
Holy fuck, I'm fast.
Well, no. I think it's remember when he's like running at Superman to stop him, and he's like Superman,
and
just,
Superman
like,
turns. Yeah, it's the best scene I thought in there.
Yeah. Overall,
but I feel like that is actually a fair one.
I am surprised the overwhelming word has been more positive than I expected.
Yeah, I'm surprised as well.
But to the point where, strangely, Gail Simone, I'm not say a traditionalist in her beliefs, but. I think a non-grim and gritty...
Someone who likes Superman, unlike Zack Snyder.
Someone who likes Superman, unlike Zack Snyder.
Maybe I think like is a different thing. I think it's an understanding thing. I don't think Zack Snyder understands Superman.
That's true.
I think he likes Superman.
He sees him as someone who should be the god over all of us.
He likes what he thinks Superman is.
Right, exactly.
But she posted some praiseworthy thoughts on it. And yeah. I've seen more people who are like... it was okay. That was better than the other one, which is not probably enough for me to watch it, but I may end up watching it out of curiosity, just so I kind of have a sense of what I may be critiquing.
I would watch it in the way it was meant to be watched, as opposed to the way Snyder decided, and watch it in the four-hour-long episodes.
Oh, right.
And
that sounds more my speed anyway.
Honestly, the critics that I'm listening to are like, what if you had done that and it had been at the same time as Falcon and Winter Soldier, and what would HBO Max and Disney would have been at fighting?
I would hate it so much more, because it would be a constant everyone comparing the two, and they're really
exactly
not the same thing at all.
But it would have been good news for both of those services if that would have been a water cooler moment.
But bad news for me, Nick, and that's more important.
I know. I understand.
I don't care about HBO Max and Disney. I care about Randy. And Randy says, I'm glad it's over. And speaking of over, the podcast is over.
Nothing ever ends, Adrian.
We'll be back next week, and until such time,
Yo-cho!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com, and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.